I've jumped the queue. The cats. Blame it on the cats.
I'm going to blame the cats. The cats.
They get everywhere.
Hello and welcome to the Beyond Shakespeare podcast. I'm your host, Robert Crichton, general overseer of the podcast, which specialises in creating full cast audio adaptations of drama from before 1642, as well as providing background and other production resources. You can support our work and get a say into what we produce by becoming a patron today. Go to www.patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. Today's episode is a discussion with Dr. Rachel Stenner about Beware the Cat by William Baldwin, written in 1553, but not published until the 1570s. And that's, as you will hear, because 1553 was one of those years featuring the death of a king, Edward VI, who was quite Protestant, and the beginning of the reign of Mary I, who was a teeny-weeny bit Catholic. And so a book that was pro-one but anti-another was quietly dropped until the wheel turned back with Elizabeth. For regular listeners, this is another story of a work of art being tossed about by the changing seas of religion in the mid-16th century, a theme we keep coming back to on this podcast. See John Bale, John Heywood, anyone living through the shifting world after the Reformation trying to make art had to make some very difficult choices. And William Baldwin, author of Beware the Cat, was no different. Beware the Cat has been given a new lease of life, thanks to a production that is popping up many times this year, and which Dr. Rachel Stenner will tell all about. Show links and details can be found on the show notes or online at bewarethecat.home.blog, and you can follow them on Twitter at bewarethecat. But that's enough of me. Here's Dr. Rachel Stenner on Beware the Cat, recorded in some haste, in May 2019.
Tell us about Beware the Cat.
Well, Beware the Cat is thought by some people to be the very first English novel, and it's about speaking cats, and it's about the lengths that a particular person, a priest, goes to understand the cats.
And when was it published, or when was it written, and when was it published?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So it was written about 1552, 1553, and the author, William Baldwin, basically self-censored. He didn't publish it until the early 1560s. That edition doesn't exist anymore, and we only have fragments of a 1570 edition, and then we have a 1584 edition. And you're going to ask me, why did he self-censor, right?
Well, I'm thinking 1553, that's the changeover from one king to a queen.
Yeah, exactly. So he'd been active under the reign of Edward VI, a time in which constraints upon the press were relaxed. And then in comes Mary I, Catholic Mary, Bloody Mary. And one of the first things she does is ban all discussion of religion in print unless it's authorised. Mm. And Beware the Cat is a text which is deeply satirical, and it's very interested in sending up the Roman Catholic Church. So Baldwin knew it was basically unpublishable at the time. Some of his friends, some of his colleagues in the London printing world, he basically worked in the media city of his day, central London, around the St. Paul's Cathedral, central bookselling area. Some of his friends and colleagues had been in prison. They'd had to go into exile. So it was a really, really difficult time. And that's why he held it back and didn't come out until things were a bit safer later on in the reign of Elizabeth.
So what do we know about the author?
He's a really interesting figure. Like quite a lot of them, he dies fairly young. He dies before he reaches the age of 40. He basically first turns up in the print shops of central London working for a guy called Edward Whitchurch, who was a regime-favoured Protestant printer. And he's a printer's assistant, so he's working with the type, he's working with the press, doing the dirty, inky-fingered business of making printed books. I'll explain in a minute why that's important for Beware the Cat. But then he also self-publishes his own writings. The first thing that he does is called A Treatise of Moral Philosophy. This comes out in 1547 and then in subsequent editions. And basically it's a compendium. It's a kind of hodgepodge of snippets from ancient philosophers. Something that the Tudors were really into, of course. It's the Renaissance, so they're all reading their humanist writings, or rather reading and producing their humanist writings. And it's actually wildly popular, and it gets reprinted throughout the 16th and well into the 17th century. So he's working on contemporary sort of political and philosophical writings. He also, really unusually, engages with the Song of Songs, also known as the Song of Solomon, mm-hmm. which is the sexy book of the Bible, right? So it's the love story between Solomon and his bride. It's this frisky book. And this was a pretty dodgy thing to be promoting in the 1550s, or rather the 1549. He does his metrical rendering, as he calls it. So he takes the prose text from the Great Bible and he turns it into English meters, into English verse. And I think, I haven't yet proved this, but I think that we could think of that as the first Petrarchan poetry printed in English. There's a lot of work to be done there to establish that, but I'm going to hopefully come back to that in the future. Mm. And then he also does satirical writings in addition to Beware the Cat. And then one of the things that people might have heard of him for is his involvement in a book called The Mirror for Magistrates. It's a collection of historical poetry, and it's a co-written compendium, really. And it's really cool because what they do is the writers imagine themselves in the print shop, and they imagine themselves opening the chronicle sources, so Holinshed, for example, and that the ancient historical figures kind of appear before them as ghosts and ventriloquize the stories of their gory deaths. And it fits within the genre of the fall of princes. So it's the idea that these are bad exemplars to follow, and that somehow these are tales which are going to advise rulers how not to behave. So there's a whole range of really interesting stuff. And then there's Beware the Cat.
where everything gets the additional feline element added, which is there a cynical aspect to that of, like, today, you know, you can write many things on social media which people will ignore, but add a cat and suddenly you'll get millions of retweets. Am I being ridiculous there?
I think you could clearly suggest that Beware the Cat started the global internet dominance of the feline species. Mm-hmm. I mean, Shakespeare also draws on Grimalkin. So Grimalkin is a figure in Beware the Cat, who's a cat goddess who gets murdered. We don't see this happen, but she gets murdered, and causes great consternation amongst the cat world. But yeah, why write a book about speaking cats is the question.
To be honest, why would you write about anything else?
Well, exactly. And I mean, there are two quite period-specific reasons why he might have done this. So, as I said already, it's an anti-Catholic satire. Mm. And of course, cat, Catholic, there's a pun there. Beware the Catholic, beware the cat. And so what the text does is it not only has this figure of Streamer, who's basically a fairly dodgy priest. He shouldn't be dabbling in alchemy. That's what he does when basically he's staying at his mate's house, who's a printer. And out on the roof, he hears this caterwauling going on all night long. And he thinks, what's all this? What's going on? He goes out, and through observation, he realizes that it's that they're communicating that there's order to the event. And then he goes away and he looks in his book of natural philosophy. So natural philosophy is probably what your listeners might know that early moderns called science. And he finds a recipe for how to understand the language of birds. So he then tweaks this and is unable to understand the language of cats. But one of the ways that Baldwin uses this process to dig at the Catholics is that it's really gruesome, and it actually parodies the Eucharist. So Baldwin kills some animals fairly violently to make his potion and his lozenges, as he calls them. Mm. So he makes a potion and he makes some tablets, which include the ingredients mustard and an ounce of new cat's dung. So it's scatological. Mm. He then eats these and drinks the potion, so there's the Eucharistic element. But this kind of opens up his senses to receive, you know, from the ether, from the beyond. And so, yeah, anyway, then he listens to the cats, and he goes out onto the roof, and he realizes that it's a court of cats. So there are some cat judges, and there's a cat called Mousley who's having to testify before the cat judges. Mm. And she's telling the story of her life. And during this story, we hear about various moments, anti-Catholic moments. So when the mass is banned, we hear about Catholics surreptitiously doing the mass. We hear about the superstitions of how a figure of the Virgin in an old woman's house is smiling when she sees the cat play with the rosary beads. And we hear about various other escapades that Mousley gets up to. So it's all quite lighthearted. It's all quite funny. But it also has a serious undertone, which is to expose what the book wants you to realise are the superstitious practices of Catholicism.
You mentioned earlier that his experience with books and the practical creation was important.
Yes. So this is how I actually got involved with this text, because a lot of my research is around the print house and the kinds of things that went on there and how authors wrote about the printing house and the world of print. So I mentioned already that with the Mirror for Magistrates, so the historical text, they set it at the printing house and they're all telling tales. This is also the fundamental kind of imaginative basis for the world that he conjures in Beware the Cat. So Streamer, the priest, is staying at his friend's house, and he identifies his friend's house as that of John Day. John Day is quite a famous Reformation printer. He prints John Fox's Acts and Monuments, so the martyrology, the Protestant martyrology that gets reprinted throughout subsequent decades and centuries. And he is also associated with this group of pro-regime printers in the reign of Edward VI, so under the protectorate of Edward Seymour. And the whole idea of making and constructing is really important to Baldwin's text. So within, you have the sort of narrative within, but it's all framed by an account of the telling of the tale. The frame tells us that a bunch of people were at court setting up the Christmas revels, making plays for the revels. And there was a priest there who told his story. And a guy called G.B., which we believe is William Baldwin, using the Latinate version of his name, writes down the tale later. So he writes down the oral tale and then he makes it into the book itself. So he tells us at the beginning that he's actually received the tale from the world of orality and he himself has turned it into the printed book. And then there's this little prefatory letter at the beginning that talks about how he's sending another book to somebody else to review before it goes into print. So this whole fantastical, bizarre, wonderful story is framed by the really mundane details of bringing a printed book into the world. Mm. But at the same time, they're not just mundane details, because it's a highly political act to do this in the context of an incoming regime, which is going to be more repressive of press freedoms. Part of the framing of, or rather part of the framing of the whole text is this idea that GB, so a fictional version of Baldwin, was at court with Master Ferrers and this version of Streamer, who's called a theologian, and they are putting these plays together for and the entertainment of the king during the revels. Now, the revels account for that particular year does indeed document the presence of George Ferrers at court, but many people use this fictional account of this revels event at Christmas to precisely date the text and to say Baldwin was at court himself making the revels, which I have argued against in my book, because I say, well, it's a fictionalized account. It doesn't mean that he definitely was there. And I tend to see these framing moments in early modern literature as predominantly rhetorical ways of getting you into the fiction rather than, you know, factual historical documents. Mm. That said, a really great colleague of mine, Matt Dimmock, here at Sussex, yesterday pointed me to a page in a book which is all about masks, so, you know, formal court entertainment, where it talks about this year in the history of the revels, where we have documentary evidence of the construction of dozens and dozens of cat tails to decorate some kind of machinery. I don't know what it was that was going to be used in this mask. And also some further cat costuming that was done in the revels. So I really want to go away and dig into this, because it might suggest that actually Baldwin perhaps was there, and also that Beware the Cat comes out of him thinking through, you know, how to talk about animal life in a different artistic context. Well, one of the things we know about early modern animals and humans is that they lived really closely together. Animals were all over the place. Thomas Nash, in his Pierce Penniless, which is a weird prose fiction from the 1590s, talks about how the dog whipper had to go around St. Paul's and clear up the dog mess every week. But contrary to that, people also think that pet keeping wasn't really a thing in the early modern period. Yet in Beware the Cat, we do have little inset stories of people dallying with their pets. So although we don't know whether Edward VI particularly liked cats, it's possible that he did, and that, you know, cats were being kept as pets in and around the royal courts. But I haven't really encountered the mask of cats, like, literally up until the last 24 hours. So I'm really excited to go away and find out more about it. But, well, you know about it then.
Well, a little. But the problem is there isn't actually that much information about it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the frustration. Yeah. We have the title. We have some details of, you know, what was produced to make it happen,
yeah.
But that's about it. This world of literature and culture, that how much does it have a conversation with itself?
I would say that the texts of the early modern period are pretty much always in conversation with themselves, about themselves, and with themselves, about each other, and also across forms. So for the theatrical performance that we're making of this text, we've turned a prose piece into a theatrical performance. And one of the interesting things about the way Baldwin frames the telling of Streamer's tale, when he is giving the account of the revels, the night before the revels, what actually prompts the discussion and gets the whole thing going is a debate about whether birds and beasts have reason.
Mm.
And that debate leads Streamer into giving his account, basically to prove that beasts do indeed have reason.
Mm.
But the thing that sets off that debate is that they are talking about a play that was being staged of Aesop's Crow. Now, as you probably know, there are loads of different Aesop fables, and we can't pin down which one they're particularly talking about.
Mm.
But the problem that they have is that one of them argues that it's uncomely, so it's inappropriate, unsuitable to make people dress on the stage as animals. Not just that, a bit worse than that, to make those animals act as if they are humans. Mm. You get this strange loop between human behaviour and animal behaviour. But yeah, the whole thing is kicked off by this debate about what it's appropriate to stage and where the boundaries might be between human and animal behaviour within that appropriateness. The person's work to go and read on this particular topic is Erica Fudge. She identifies the role of Aesop's fables in the humanist classroom. So the fables have a weird status in that they're part of the classical tradition. So therefore, if you're a Renaissance person, they're good. They're elite. But at the same time, not only are they descended, do they come from the mouths of slaves in ancient Greece, but they are used as schoolroom texts to teach Latin grammar. And so therefore, they're of low status, they're debased. But they're core to humanist educational practices, the point of which was to establish the innate superiority of humans through our acquisition of language, through our eloquence, through our ethical standards. But if you're using Aesop, i.e. the actions of animals, to demonstrate that, then you're not asserting human superiority. You're in fact saying humans are like animals because we can model ourselves on these kinds of behaviours. So again, I don't think it's accidental that Baldwin brings in Aesop right at the start of this text, which is all about the relationship between humans and animals and the capacities that animals might have that we habitually want to write off.
Well, we've mentioned that you're doing this as a stage production, which is why we're here. So tell me about that.
This is such an exciting thing to be doing. Basically, I was thinking when I was working on this text some time ago, how can I get people to know about it? And I thought it's so interesting, it's so exciting and weird. A brilliant way would be to have it done as a performance. So if you've got Cats, the musical, in your head, you need to take that out of your head. It's quite a different way of bringing the Cats to the stage, in that basically we're reading the text aloud. So it's a rehearsed reading rather than people gallivanting about in cat costumes. I've been working with a fantastic dramaturg and theatre practitioner called Terry O'Connor, who's a member of the Ensemble Forced Entertainment, a contemporary theatre group. And it's really her vision which has brought the whole thing onto the stage. So we have a series of readers. The story, which in Baldwin's text passes between lots of different narrators, passes between the readers on the stage. The printed book itself, like many other early modern books, has a bunch of marginalia, so printed notes in the margin which comment on the text, which undermine it in various ways, give you different info. So we use printed signs that are held up to comment on what's being said, and that works to great comic effect at certain moments or to amplify what's being said. And then a huge part of the production is a suite of drawings that have been made by Penny McCarthy, who's a fantastic fine artist who works at Sheffield Hallam University and also exhibits all her work all over the world. There are a series of pen and ink drawings which your listeners can see if they visit our blog, and they can find versions of them there. And they are responses to the text. So in some moments she's illustrating things that happen. In some moments she's taken a particular image and she's amplified that and interpreted it in a particular way. So one of the key scenes is a scene which takes place in a wood. So you have a beautiful kind of moonlit wood being projected up behind the performers. And the way we use the images is that we have quite an old school projector, and we have them shuffling through the images and placing them onto the projector, and then they get amplified up behind on the screen behind. So there's this constant dialogue between the visual image, what you're hearing through the read narration, and also what you're seeing through the signs. which is very much in tune with Baldwin's ideas for his text, where, as I was saying earlier, he takes an oral tale and then turns it into a written text. So yeah, that's how the performance works, and it's about an hour long. Oh, it's also got some songs that we wrote, and I think that's pretty much it. We've done it once before. We made it last year for the University of Sheffield's Festival of the Mind. Myself and then Terry O'Connor, who's a dramaturg I mentioned, Professor Francis Babbage, who's an academic from Sheffield, the three of us are the main leads. Then there's Penny with the images, and there are three further performers, Bob Mackay from Sheffield, Robin Orfatelli, also from Sheffield, and Adam Piet, also from Sheffield, all colleagues from the School of English. So it's a very Sheffield project. I think I didn't count that out. I think that's eight people. And then we have two marvellous cat performers who are the only people who are notionally appearing actually as cats in the shows.
But no leotards.
No leotards, no. It's very tasteful. I used to work at the University of Sheffield, and they funded us to get this project off the ground. And we performed it in September in their town centre Spiegel tent on a Saturday night. We didn't know what the reception was going to be, but it was brilliantly received. The house was packed, and we had to turn people away at the door. So we were thrilled about that. And that's, you know, why we were able to get funding to make it happen again. And it's also been screened in Kent at the University of Kent, and also in Cyprus at an academic conference in Cyprus. And we're also hoping to get some funding to refilm it over the course of the summer, so that we've got another artifact that we can use to show it to people, basically.
I would have thought that this has legs. If only because it's got cats.
Yes, I know.
I think on marketing, you don't need to. You can almost not bother telling anyone its auspices. You just the title itself, I think, has almost enough leverage to it to actually, because this is what I have all the time, is going, right, how can I sell this play? How can I find people? Well, I don't want to sell it as, oh, it's a play that's very rarely performed. I want people to come and see it because they want to see something fun and engaging and exciting. So first thing I look at is the title any good?
Yeah, it is a really good title. And you know what? We've had more invitations than we can cope with to perform it. People have responded so excitedly. It's brilliant. And also you get all these early modernists who go, oh, yeah, I really love the word The Cat. And it kind of, people have read it, but sort of haven't really spent that much time on it. But the people who've read it really, really know.
The advantage as a text is it's not very long.
No, it's not.
No, it's 17,500 words or something similar. And, you know, that's, even without, you know, doing anything with it, that's a couple of hours read at most.
Yeah.
You know, you can rattle through it really quickly.
Actually, on our, people can just find this themselves if they go on the internet, but if they travel through our blog, they can find a link to read an edited version of the text online, of Baldwin's text. And actually, a plan that we've got for the future is to publish the performance text, because we have edited it, and as I said, we've added the songs and we've changed things around a little bit, in a book, which, because it's an, as a research project, it's really interdisciplinary, because it's not just got the fine art, the early modern, it's got the adaptation, it's got the theatre practice, it's got animal studies. So we've been talking a lot about the animals in the text, and Bob Mackay, who's a colleague from the University of Sheffield, runs the Sheffield Animals Research Centre, because as you probably know, animal studies is a really booming field at the moment, coming out of post-humanist inquiries. And so there's that whole strand to it, a philosophical and theoretical strand as well. So yeah, we want to publish the performance text, and we want to publish it with a series of small essays around it as well, that really look at it from, you know, lots of different perspectives.
When and where is it on, or at least at this precise moment in time in 2019, when is it coming up?
So the next opportunity to see it is Friday the 10th of May here at the University of Sussex in the Attenborough Centre for the Creative Arts in Brighton. It's free, so you don't have to pay, but you do need to book, and you can book through the Attenborough Centre website. The next performance is Saturday the 7th of July in Stratford-upon-Avon at the RSC's venue called The Other Place. That, we were told, was sold out, which is absolutely amazing, but we've now found out that they're releasing a bunch of further tickets, so you can still get to see it at the RSC, also for free, but you do need to book. And then the final iteration of it is Leeds at the Workshop Theatre on the 23rd of November this year. So lots of opportunities to see it in different parts of the country, and as I say, all free, but you do need to book for each one of them.
And here are a few additional moments from the discussion that fell aside of the flow of chat, but are nevertheless interesting.
So the Irish connection in Beware the Cat is that one of the key episodes that kind of establishes the cat goddess Grimalkin as a presence to be alarmed by takes place in Ireland, and it is told to the listeners by somebody who's been in Ireland and has travelled back to London. And what happens in this episode is absolutely bizarre. There are two kerns, as they're called, so low-status Irish men who are out marauding, and they go and pillage a town, and they steal a sheep and a cow, and then they go and take sanctuary in church. And when they're in the church, they get hungry, and they decide to kill the beasts and eat them. And in creeps this, as they think, normal and small little cat. And she speaks to them in Irish, and she says, Shane Fowell, which according to the text means give me some meat. And she eats some meat, and then she asks for more. And then we hear that, like a cormorant, did she ask for more, and did she devour more? And she basically eats a whole sheep and a whole cow and gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And then a bit later on, as the two kerns are going off down the road, we hear that such a sight of cats appeared, so a massive gang of cats appeared, and they basically kill one of the men. So it's contributing to that notion of Ireland as wild and as uncivilized, and again digging at the Catholicism. But yeah, the Tudors were very interested in Ireland, weren't they? And it's interesting to see it coming up in this text, which is, I would say, so important for the history of the novel.
Which is a history which we haven't really touched on, but is also to some degree outside our wheelhouse, though. If there's how do you see it fitting in?
So its editors claim it as the first English novel, and I think that's a defensible claim, even though purists and scholars of the 18th century would say, no, you've got to look at the 18th century to see where the novel really emerges. But there are lots of prose fictions of the 16th century, which typically have been quite neglected, although in the last 20 years or so, people are paying more attention to them. But the typical features that people think of as being novelistic are entirely there in Beware the Cat. So character and motivation, everyday settings, a coherent narrative which takes place over a large scale and has a linear plot and a beginning and a middle and an end. It's all there. And lots of the prose fictions of the time are translations. This isn't a translation. It's an original piece of prose fiction. But that's where I'd position it. And I think that we could revisit our histories of the novel. Well, I mean, scholars of prose fiction are doing this for the 16th century. And I think that's a conversation that needs to continue.
And I'd like to thank Dr. Rachel Stenner for joining me on this episode. Go out and book for the shows if you can, and tell us about it at Beyond Shakes. But till next time, I've been your host, Robert Crichton, and you've been listening to the Beyond Shakespeare podcast.